This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We have had this week too big to fail, insider trading and federal budgets, lions and tigers and bears, oh my. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for the Ides of March, the 15th of March. Glad you could be with us today. And we will begin with 4, maybe 5 minutes of live radio to decipher what happened the past 5 days. Because there has been actually quite a bit in the world of business and the economy. To do that with us, we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. They are in our studios in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So listen, I'm just going to tick a couple of things off, all right, and then we'll talk about them. First of all, a big hearing on J.P. Morgan Chase and its London Whale, $6 billion loss in the Senate today. Cardiff, you were there, right? Or you were blogging it, Ryan?
Wasn't there in person, but I did 6 hours of live blogging, and I'm fried. And I'm also impressed by whatever adhesive Carl Levin, the senator, uses to keep those glasses out.
That's right.
All right. That way.
We'll get there in a minute. Hang on, because there's more, right? Big plea bargain today. SAC, a big hedge fund, paying $600 million to settle charges of insider trading. And we talked to Carney yesterday about Richard Fisher, the president of the Dallas Fed, going to CPAC tomorrow to talk about too big to fail. Lee Gallagher, have we learned nothing the past 5 years? Come on.
You could certainly say that. But didn't we know that already, that we have learned nothing? I mean, hasn't that already been proved?
Yes, I think.
It's true. It's true. I mean, even the charge that SAC affiliate settled for was the age-old insider trading charge, mm-hmm. which has been going on as long as we can all remember. That has relatively little to do with all of the excess that got us into the financial crisis. Of everything that did happen, it wasn't really insider trading.
All right. Well, let's back up and let's get to J.P. Morgan Chase, because that arguably is the more interesting, titillating one of these, I think. Cardiff, the report that the Senate committee issued today issued last night, I guess, was scathing. I mean, they blistered J.P. Morgan Chase. I found it interesting that the CEO of that company, Jamie Dimon, was not there.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why they didn't ask him to come back, especially because there were a lot of revelations in this report that hadn't come out earlier. But I completely agree. I mean, the details of this report were incredibly damning, and they really portrayed a bank that showed an impressive combination of hubris and incompetence. You had senior managers that were misleading to the public, misleading to regulators, changing risk models on the fly and the way they value the amount of assets in their portfolios to hide losses. I mean, this was a really staggering and scathing report. And I think, you know, you just mentioned Richard Fisher and talking about breaking up the banks.
Yeah.
I mean, this is going to be a really powerful selling point for advocates of that particular policy.
Well, Lee, I'm about to torpedo, I think, any chances of getting Jamie Dimon on this program. But how is it, right? Here we go. How is it that everybody has thought for so long that Jamie Dimon specifically and J.P. Morgan Chase in particular are so great when they're doing things like this?
Well, that's a good question. But, you know, Jamie Dimon and the bank has acknowledged over and over again, this was an enormous mistake. We don't know. We are embarrassed by this. This shouldn't have happened. This was a huge loss. We weren't watching the risk controls. But on the other hand, this is a and I think Jamie Dimon even said this, you know, this $6 billion loss was, you know, they have billions more. I mean, this was not damaging materially to the company. It was damaging to its reputation.
Well, yeah, so, but isn't that kind of the point, right? I mean, we all think badly enough of banks to begin with, and now they're doing this and saying, yeah, no, but it's only $6
billion. It is the point, and I'm sure they wish it didn't happen, but it did not take the company down in any way, shape, or form, and it wouldn't. Because it's so big.
Yeah. Right. In point of fact, too big to fail. So, Cardiff, this SAC settlement today with at the SEC, I found it interesting that neither party admitted nor denied guilt, either the parties involved or accused. They're paying $600 million. If you flash back to Michael Milken from 25 years ago, the guy went to jail for 10 years.
Yeah, he did. I mean, there were some pretty important differences between the two cases, right? I mean, in the case of Milken, it wasn't just a problem for Drexel, his company. He was charged, indicted, and convicted individually. Stevie Cohen hasn't yet. But I think when you look at the amount of the settlement, $600 million, I mean, that's an awful lot of money to pay if you think these are charges that were brought unjustly or you didn't do anything wrong. My guess is that it means that the SEC isn't done yet and that we haven't heard the last of this.
But seriously, Steve Cohen, the guy who runs SAC, I mean, he can find $600 million under his couch cushions.
Yeah, that's right.
That's true. So you could argue that, okay, maybe it doesn't mean anything. You know, it might just mean this is what they're paying just to have it go away.
Just to have it go away.
And they haven't charged, as Cardiff just said, they haven't charged Steve Cohen with anything. So whether they have anything on him, it doesn't sound like it. And maybe they will at some point. But $600 million to SAC is less than $6 billion is to
right.
Well, this is like an SAT question.
That's right.
I don't think they're done yet. I think they're still marshaling resources. Yeah,
right.
I think the SEC
they could
still
be. But you know, the whole point with this and with what happened with the financial crisis, excess is not illegal. You know, I mean, insider trading is a different story entirely.
On.
And I'm just saying why it's been so tough. You'd think they'd had ample opportunity with some other cases, with maybe Lehman Brothers, with maybe MF Global, and yet. Nothing
and
yet.
All right. We got to go. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Cardiff Garcia from FT Alphaville. See you guys. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Bye-bye. I should mention in passing, by the way, the air finally went out of the rally on the Dow. Today, all three major indices lost ground. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama has clean energy ambitions. He's been talking about that for quite a while now. Today, he got a bit more specific. He wants the government to do research and development on cars and trucks that don't need oil or gas to go. He needs $2 billion to make that happen. But the question is, the state of the federal budget being what it is, where's that money going to come from? Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
$2 billion sounds like a lot. Until you put it in context. For one, it's spread out over the next decade. So we're talking about $200 million each year. And the pool it'd be pulled from, the royalty revenue from offshore oil and gas drilling, that was more than $5 billion last year. Andy Radford is with the American Petroleum Institute.
Well, you look at that $200 million a year out of about $5 billion, so we could do the math. I'm not a mathematician, but it's...
Lucky for us, my calculator is a mathematician, and we're talking about less than 4%. The White House estimates those revenues will increase over the next several years, which Radford guesses is realistic for a couple of reasons.
The price of oil.
And?
We've had some major discoveries in offshore that have been coming online.
The more oil and gas that gets pumped and the more it costs, the more the government takes in through the royalty program. But why spend that extra cash on creating cleaner cars and trucks? I mean, everyone in D.C. right now is talking about deficit reduction. Why not use it for that? William Galston is from the Brookings Institution.
Economists agree that there are certain kinds of what they call public goods that the market, left to its own devices, won't supply enough of.
Developing alternatives to oil, he says, is one of those public goods. $200 million a year is tiny when it comes to the deficit, but invested in research, it could pay off for all of us in a much bigger way. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
On now to the latest from Espoo, Finland. Rovio, the Finnish company that makes Angry Birds, is, get this, launching a television show based on its crazily popular video game. The debut is this weekend. It's animated. You can see it through the app on your phone or broadcast if you're overseas. Sally Herships reports now on the business of migrating angry birds from tiny screen to television.
The birds in Angry Birds should be happy. It's gone from a 99-cent app on your phone to its own 3-minute cartoons. The game launched about 4 years ago.
There were other mobile games that debuted alongside it, but I can't name any of them.
Evan Narcisse writes for video game blog Kotaku. Angry Birds' success has created merchandise deals. Narcisse says the brand is so popular, the Angry Birds t-shirt is the new Bart Simpson shirt. But remember, Bart got his start on TV, which is where Angry Birds is heading.
In a traditional circumstance, Angry Birds might be a show on the Cartoon Network.
That's Mark Robichaux, editor of Multichannel News. He says Angry Birds' migratory path from game to TV bypasses TV networks. Players can download animations on their phones. Robichaux says that way the company can keep advertising profits, which would otherwise go someplace like the Cartoon Network.
And look, I'll tell you something right now. I've seen a teaser for the cartoon. This is not highbrow entertainment.
The cartoons feature the same characters as the game. There's violence, but more like a scene from The Smurfs than Call of Duty, which Kellogg School of Management professor Tim Kalkin says is a big reason the brand is so successful.
They're not just reaching gamers. They're reaching just huge numbers of people.
Rovio is a private company, so we don't know exactly what it's worth, but analysts estimate it's several billion dollars. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The recession has been over officially for almost 4 full years. June makes it 4 years. The problem with that official thing, though, the one that's based on data and analysis and trend lines, is that it doesn't account for what happens out in the real economy, the one people have to live in. There's a documentary airing on HBO Monday night. It's called American Winter. It follows 8 low-income or no-income families in Portland, Oregon, through 2011 and through 2012. That's after, remember, the recession was officially over with. Brothers Joe and Harry Gantz made that film. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
The thing that hit me about this movie, Harry, and it hit you smack in the face, and it doesn't take long to get into it, is that this is really about the kids. It's about the children in these families. Did you sense that when you were making this movie?
Absolutely. When these parents are going through a lot of stress dealing with the economic situation that they're in, a lot of them do their best to shield their kids from it. Mm-hmm. But of course, the kids can't be shielded from the water being turned off. So it affects them in deep emotional ways and has long-term impact on them in terms of their education, their self-worth, all the things that parents worry about kids having.
Let's listen to this just for a second. It's one of these kids.
Honestly, the way I look at it is I don't know how I'm going to make it. I have no money saved up for college. I don't have any of that stuff. How am I going to be successful? I worry about that every day.
Joe, that kid is 13 years old. I mean, that's insane that he's worrying about this stuff.
This stress is something that these families deal with every day, all day, and it filters down to the kids, and it really makes the quality of life, you know, really diminished.
Harry, you were right in these people's faces for the 5-6 months, whatever it was, that it took you to make this movie. You were in their homes. You went on dates with some of these couples. You went all over. And I do wonder why they let you in. Why do you think they let you into their lives like this?
I think a lot of these families feel like the world doesn't care about them, that there's not a lot of attention paid to them. It's a full-time job not only to work but also to navigate the social service system. And they felt like they would be willing to allow us into this part of their life so the rest of the world could see what they were going through. You know, these guys don't have any lobbyists in Washington. And even though all of these decisions that are being made about budgets and cuts affect them, this would be one way that they would have a voice.
Were you, as a filmmaker, saddened by what you saw, or did you know what you were getting into?
I think Joe should answer that
All right,
question.
Joe, go ahead.
Well, it's difficult to spend this time in these people's lives and watch them struggle with paying bills, putting food on the table, keeping a roof over their heads, and, you know, not, you know, reach out and say, well, let me buy you dinner tonight.
Did you ever do that?
Well, towards the end of the film, we did break some of the rules yeah. that we had set up. We made a situation where we would pay them a daily fee at the end of editing because we didn't want to take their lives out of orbit. And we wanted to follow what was truly happening for them.
This film takes place in Portland, Oregon, which is not speaking for myself anyway. I mean, you think of Portland and you think of craft beer and hipsters and sort of Brooklyn on the West Coast, and you don't think of these problems with economic life. And maybe part of that's my ignorance. But were you surprised by what you found up there? I mean –
Well, we weren't really surprised. This is, in a sense, the other side of Portlandia.
Yeah, we chose Portland because we felt that L.A. or New York would feel to middle America as, you know, not us. So we wanted to find a city that felt a little bit more like middle America. Mm. And so we chose Portland, not knowing all that much about it.
There was an amazing amount of cognitive dissonance for me in this film, watching these families having to run an extension cord to their neighbor's house because their power had been shut off, filling up buckets outside with a hose from their neighbor's house because their water had been shut off. That juxtaposed with the conversation that is happening on the political level in Washington, which seems so detached from the reality of the real economy in this country.
And that's why we made the film. We made the film because we felt that there was this economic discussion going on at every level, but it wasn't taking into consideration what was happening with real families all across this country. And we felt that if people could see how families were struggling, it would be easier to kind of connect with what's really going on in this country right now.
Harry Gantz and his brother Joe. The film is called American Winter. It's on HBO on Monday. Guys, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the business of tennis tournaments.
They are saying, look, we're going to be in trouble if we have to try to live up to what Indian Wells is doing. We can't afford it.
Larry Ellison serves up an ace. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, wait, what's that music? Oh, is this sad music? Haven't heard that in a while. The Dow Industrials broke a 10-day run-up today, dropped almost a 10%, 25 points, closed at 14,514. The NASDAQ off 0.3%, 9 points, 3249. The number you're looking for, the S&P 500 fell a 10%, 2 points, finished at 1560. Financials were mixed. J.P. Morgan Chase took off nearly 2%. Goldman Sachs dipped 0.5%. Bank of America added on nearly 4%. Morgan Stanley chalked up 3.5% today. DirecTV turned off its bid for a South American unit of Vivendi, clicked up 4.5% in doing so. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.99%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. The Senate Judiciary Committee discusses how comprehensive immigration reform should address the needs of women and families. And the International Olympic Committee's Evaluation Commission visits Madrid. The city is in competition with Istanbul and Tokyo to host the 2020 Olympic Games. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Silicon Valley is the entrepreneurial center of the tech industry. No real doubt about that. But San Francisco, just 40 miles north, is becoming the heart and soul of it. Tech workers who don't want to live in the sprawling suburbs have migrated up there. Hundreds of tech-related businesses have set up shop. But the culture that's been taking hold has not come without controversy. Nishat Kurwa from Turnstile News has the story.
If you're a young professional employed by one of the big tech companies, contemporary San Francisco is a carnival of delights. On a given weekend, you might choose from a pricey music festival rollicking through landmark city parks.
San Francisco, be my choir!
the soft opening of a high-end neighborhood grocery store.
We're excited. We're really excited. Yeah.
Or a party for a podcasting startup at a tri-level downtown club. Thousands of tech workers live in vibrant neighborhoods like San Francisco's Mission District and commute in corporate shuttles to their jobs in Silicon Valley. Just a couple of miles away, there's a neighborhood where all of this growth has been conspicuously absent.
We're on the corner of Golden Gate and Jones, and what you're going to see are those people.
Those people are poor people, says Joseph Thomas, who lives here in the Tenderloin District.
Everybody who doesn't have what you have, a nice place to live, maybe a car, nice clothes, a decent meal every day.
A quarter of Tenderloin residents live under the poverty line. Social service centers are clustered in this neighborhood, alongside drug activity and immigrant families who can't afford most other areas. Walk a few blocks and you hit a stretch of Market Street, San Francisco's main thoroughfare. It's also been untouched by growth, until recently. Nearly 2 years ago, Twitter leased a building here. To get Twitter to stay and grow in San Francisco, the city gave the company tax breaks on its stock options and payroll.
The youthful energy that comes with a project like this, or any place where you're going to put 7,000 employees on a city block that's been essentially vacant for an entire decade, will, you know, just create an energy for the area that we haven't seen here.
Tom McDonnell is VP of leasing for Shorenstein. The development firm renovated this Art Deco building for Twitter. Other tech companies followed, renting space near the cool kids. Microsoft's Yammer is here. So is the online retailer One Kings Lane. And 4,500 residential units will soon go up near Twitter's headquarters.
Them buying that building jacked up the rents astronomically.
That's Tenderloin resident Joseph Thomas, who says the neighborhood is becoming unaffordable for middle and low-income folks.
My merchant friends on Market Street, two or three of them are out of business.
San Francisco Board of Supervisors President David Chu says the explosion of the tech sector is directly responsible for a positive change.
Our budget deficit today is a quarter of what it was just 4 years ago.
Welcoming companies like Twitter here, says Chu, brought in revenue that allows San Francisco to strengthen its social safety net. Another ripple effect Chu cites, job creation. The Bay Area Council Economic Institute found that for every new tech industry job, four non-tech jobs opened up. Critics say those new jobs aren't necessarily good enough jobs. Sarah Short heads the Housing Rights Committee, an advocacy group.
There will be opportunities to service those tech workers, but those are exactly the kind of jobs that won't sustain families who are trying to afford the extremely high rents in this market.
Short says many of San Francisco's bus drivers or janitors have already been priced out of living in the city where they work. For many people born and raised in San Francisco, its new economy is at odds with the city's reputation for progressive social change. For many people whom tech has delivered here, the city's future is bright. The mid-market area is only the latest neighborhood where how much money you have may determine whether you get to stay. In San Francisco, I'm Nishat Kurwa for Marketplace.
Nishat Kurwa is with TurnstileNews.com. That's a project of Youth Radio. Larry Ellison, the co-founder, the CEO, and the biggest single shareholder in Oracle, is a very, very rich man. Top 10 in the world in point of fact. He owns his own Hawaiian island. He's got a yacht as long as a football field, and he downsized to get that, by the way. He's also got a tennis tournament that's going on right now out near Palm Springs, California. The BNP Paribas Open, it's called. Ellison and his bank account were seen as a huge boon to pro tennis when he bought that tournament, at least at first. Now, all the other tournaments are getting jealous, as Ben Bergman reports.
4 years ago, a tennis tournament in Indian Wells, California was on the verge of moving to Doha or Shanghai, joining the long list of American tournaments to go overseas. When Ellison bought the tournament, he was hailed as a savior, Santa Claus with a tennis racket. The BNP Paribas Open is so popular now it's known as the fifth Grand Slam and attracts close to 400,000 fans to Indian Wells. Stars like Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal say Indian Wells is one of their favorite tournaments. Nadal is especially fond of Larry Ellison.
It means a lot for me and especially for tennis. Have somebody like Larry who is supporting like this our sport, I think, is very important.
Ellison wanted to give players a $1.6 million bump in prize money. The Women's Tennis Association quickly approved the increase, but the men's tour, the ATP, didn't. Players like Britain's Andy Murray were stunned that an organization supposed to represent them would allow money to be left on the table.
Obviously, everyone was disappointed with the decision, so my opinion is that if a tournament wants to increase its prize money, it should be allowed to.
The owners of other tournaments worried that a prize increase at Indian Wells would diminish their events. Neil Harmon writes about tennis for the Times of London.
No one can stop Larry Ellison. He can do whatever he wants, but it makes everyone feel very nervous.
After months of delay, the ATP finally approved the prize increase before the start of the two-week tournament. That was despite opposition from other owners who look at Ellison's seemingly unlimited bank account with a mix of envy and fear.
In these times of austerity, there isn't the money there. So they are saying, look, we're going to be in trouble if we have to try to live up to what Indian Wells is doing. We can't afford it.
But Raymond Moore, the head of the BNP Paribas Open, says other tournaments are just being stingy. His event just announced a $70 million expansion that includes building a second stadium with a Nobu sushi restaurant courtside.
I can name 8 other tournaments off the top of my head who have the financial ability to increase the prize money if they wanted to. They just choose not to.
Indian Wells is already a mandatory event for players, but Moore says increasing prize money makes them want to be there and win even more. The CEO says he doesn't have a blank check from Ellison.
He didn't get to be the 5th richest man in the world by just spending money and throwing it out the window. These are calculated business decisions.
Both the men's and women's winner of this weekend's final will take home $1 million. Ellison is considering making next year's purse even bigger. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which brings with it the promise of bad news for Oprah Winfrey and her eponymous Oprah Winfrey Network. It and she are in some trouble with Canadian telecommunications regulators who say OWN is concentrating too much on food, fitness, and beauty and not providing enough educational programming, which does bring this question prominently to mind. They knew it was Oprah when they granted that broadcast license, right? Okay, we're done. We got to go. That's Marketplace this Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, blended weddings.
I'm Jewish.
I'm Hindu.
We're the Hindus.
And budgeting.
Two ceremonies, right?
And there's two sets of decorations, and there's two receptions, and there's two outfits.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.